председатель Конституционного суда
Валерий Зорькин опубликовал в российской газете
манифест об отмене крепостного права.
Нет, мы не будем отменять крепостного права.
Это сделает Россию современной.
Начал Столыпин с жестокой борьбы против...
Крепостное право отменили!
Serfdom is freedom. Liberation is slavery. These days, the signs of the times aren't exactly subtle. Constitutional Court Chairman Valery Zorkin's recent article praising serfdom and criticizing its abolition raised more than a few eyebrows. Serfdom was, quote, the main staple holding together the internal unity of the nation, unquote, Zorkin wrote in the official government newspaper Российская Газета. In its abolition by Tsar Alexander II in 1861, quote, destroyed the already greatly weakened connection between the two basic social classes of the nation, the nobility and the peasantry. The result, he wrote, were the rebellions and revolutions that gripped Russia in the late 19th and early 20th century, which he went on to compare to the social, political, and economic upheavals of the early 1990s. But as remarkable as Zorkin's defense of serfdom was, it was another part of his lengthy article that caught my attention, the subtle critique of Pyotr Stolypin, the early 20th century reformist prime minister, somebody who Vladimir Putin has repeatedly said he admires. Russia, of course, is not going back to serfdom, and Zorkin, despite the claims of some of his critics, wasn't calling for this. But articles like this don't appear by accident. And this one appears to reflect and reinforce a deeply reactionary and even retrograde groupthink that is increasingly dominating Kremlin politics. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean.
Hello.
Well, this isn't the first time Zorkin has popped up as something as of a pamphleteer for the Kremlin. Back in December 2011 and January 2012, if you remember, just as the protest movement was gathering steam, he penned a pair of articles warning that continued mass demonstrations would lead to a, quote, national catastrophe, and claiming that foreign powers were seeking to undermine Russia's sovereignty in the name of democratic change. These statements, of course, later became staples of Kremlin rhetoric and policy. This piece, of course, was framed as something of a historical legal analysis, but in Russia, history is never just history, especially these days. And these pieces didn't take place, and I didn't appear. Zorkin's piece in the Российская Газета didn't appear in isolation. This week, he was at a legal conference in Seoul, where he gave a speech slamming liberalism, slamming Western liberalism, which he called the greatest danger to the world today. I'm saying it in of all things encourages sexual minorities to fight for their rights. Horrors, horrors. So, Sean, you're the historian. What was your takeaway? What was Zorkin really saying here? And what do you think it portends?
I think it was a really interesting document, and I encourage listeners to read it if they can, because it really states, I think, the kind of what conservative thinking in Russia is nowadays. The things I took from it was, first, it was definitely an anti-great reform or anti-revolutionary manifesto and analysis in a way. It was against the kind of large reforms that structurally changed Russian society. And what the reasoning he gave for that is because, as you said, it broke the unity between the classes of Russia, the elite and the masses. And he spoke about this repeatedly, that abolishing serfdom broke essentially the power vertical, and it alienated the masses from the elite. And here it gives an interesting view into how Zorkin views Russian society as an organic, where all the parts of it work in concert with one another. And this goes along quite well with his arguments against liberalism as a danger, because liberalism, seeing seeing society as a conglomerate of individuals is against this idea of an organic society. And a lot of it kind of reminded me of the Russian 19th century idea subordinist, which views Russian society as this kind of organic organic whole where everybody works in concert with one another. So I found it interesting that conservative thinking is going back to 19th century ideas, and this one in particular, Slavophile ideas. So that the kind of takeaway I took from it for the present, it really is an argument against any kind of structural reforms that would break what he sees as the unity between the people and, I assume, the state, or at least the leader in terms of Putin.
Right. And it was interesting where he linked this to the 90s. But the other bit as I said in the intro, that caught my eye was, and it was a subtle, it wasn't like a harsh critique, but he did criticize Pyotr Stolypin. And Vladimir Putin has repeatedly stressed his admiration for Stolypin. He's often seen as one of Putin's three great models. If you look at Putin's historical heroes, they are Andropov, Nicholas I, and Stolypin, right? If you look at and what is this saying? Well, Stolypin, if you look at those three, was the most urbane or liberal of the three. He was a conservative reformist, if you will. And maybe I'm reading too much into this, but I interpreted the Stolypin critique as maybe a sign that's on the outs now.
Well, the Stolypin, no, I wouldn't take it that far. I think the Stolypin critique flowed directly from his discussion of serfdom, in the sense that he says that society essentially was lagging behind the reforms. And he spoke about this in terms of Stolypin's break of the commune, that essentially peasants weren't ready to be unleashed as individuals in Russian society, that he overestimated the cultural level of society. And it really does put forward a very paternalist understanding of the relationship between the leadership or the elite and the masses, that the elite, this bond that holds them together, the elite is supposed to take care of the masses. It kind of reminded his discussion of serfdom kind of reminded me of Americans' defense of slavery in terms of the paternalism of the slaveholder over black slaves.
Yeah. No, I want to actually, the quote on Stolypin I thought was very interesting. He says, Stolypin's reforms took communal justice away from the peasants and in return gave them individual freedom that almost none of them knew how to use, and which deprived their community guarantees of survival. This gave them what Eric Fromm called, quote, intolerable freedom. Unbearable freedom from previous norms, old morality, and old notions of what is fair and proper. This argument that, I mean, he's saying they weren't ready for freedom, essentially.
Basically,
anything to read into that in the present day? Because this article wasn't just a historical article. I think he was speaking or trying to say something relevant to the present day.
It seems that in that understanding is that any kind of move towards a liberalization of Russian society, that society just isn't ready yet for whatever reasons, that you can't break this bond. If you break this bond, it is dangerous because, as he said, when this bond was broken, this is what allowed for the revolutionary movement to develop in Russia. So, this is his interpretation.
Right. So I guess six or seven years later, they're still not ready, right?
Yes.
Mark, I know you were a bit more skeptical about the relevance of this article to today's Russia. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's certainly the case that Zorkin, has consistently presented a particular perspective, which is opposed to kind of revolutionary changes, radical changes. I mean, this is something that, I mean, for me, the best analyses have come from Will Partlett at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, who's pointed out that even if you go back to 1993, when Yeltsin was shelling parliament, Zorkin was coming out against that, not necessarily so much because he was a confirmed defender of the parliamentarians themselves, but more precisely because he was concerned about what he saw as an attempt to create an over-radical and over-rapid change in the political and social system. So, you know, this is something that has been a consistent Zorkin line, and probably is one of the reasons why he's now chairman of the Constitutional Court, because it's a convenient, it means that you have essentially an element of ballast there. I think the interesting thing is, yes, of course, this is hearkening back to a paternalistic 19th century notion. But again, I think it's worth remembering that a key element of that particular notion was the sense that there was a personal relationship between the Tsar and the peasant. The lack of intercessionary authorities, that basically the Tsar was God's representative and ultimately was therefore the sort of the intercessionary with the divine, but also that the Tsar was the one person that you could turn to in peasant mythology to try and fix the problems that are all around. The woes of the peasants are because of the landlords and the bureaucrats and the tax collectors and the police officers. And if only the Tsar knew what was going on, then everything would be fixed.
Well, today we call that ruchnoye upravlenie, or manual control, as
well. Well, exactly. So, I mean, in this respect, I mean, actually, what Zorkin is doing is coming up with a very sort of strong reinforcement and defense of the current system, the way Putin has constituted it. But I think it's fascinating that we once again have, and this was something that one saw often in Soviet times, is history being used as a way for Aesopian metaphorical conversations about the present. Just as in Soviet times, they would sometimes be talking about other countries, really as a way of trying to talk about what's actually going on in the Soviet Union. And I wonder if that also says something precisely about the new mood, the new cautions about how you can talk within, you know, and carry out, shall we say, public intra-elite conversations. Because let's face it, you know, Zorkin is not talking to, you know, the truck drivers of Vladivostok.
No.
When he writes this, I mean, you know, it's in the government newspaper, which is explicitly really for the Vlasti, and you know, it's being written in terms that are clearly for an insider audience. So, in this respect, I find myself wondering. I mean, yes, Zorkin says this kind of thing fairly regularly. So on one level, we could just simply say, well, we're just plucking one particular point. But on the other hand, whether it does reflect something currently within the currents of elite discourse, you know, whether actually there was a sense that there was a need to more or less say, you know, stay the course. There is no scope for any kind of dramatic change that would not end disastrously.
Well, it's interesting, given our conversation last week with Ben Judah, when Ben was saying how nervous the technocratic wing of the elite is right now, and where they see that the rules of the game seem to have changed and they don't seem to understand them anymore. Zorkin's also has often been kind of used as a barometer, but also a messenger. I mean, if you read what Zorkin was writing back in December 2011, you would have gotten a pretty good idea. When we were sitting here thinking, you know, this regime's in deep trouble and we might be on the cusp of major political change in Russia. If we were reading Sorkin back then, we probably would have had a good idea, with the benefit of hindsight, you know, where this regime is going. And that's what made me pay. That's one of the things that made me pay close attention to this, given the fact that the technocratic wing of the elite is very, very nervous right now, doesn't really seem to like where this is going, doesn't really understand the rules. What kind of coded message did you see other than stay the course? I mean, did you see anything more in this?
Well, I mean, let's just actually just dwell on one point, by the way. I mean, Zorkin is very definitely the ultra technocrat. And the interesting thing is, I mean, this is a man who has considerable political power by influence of his position and has not turned it into a vessel for massive amounts of money making, has not really sought to extend his authority to become a sort of political mover and shaker within the system. You know, this is a man who very clearly has a particular role, relishes that role, plays that role to the fullest, but has not used it as an attempt to try and play wider Kremlin politics.
Mm-hmm. So in this respect, he's not an independent player, though. He does as he's told.
Well, no, but that's the whole point. But anyway, I mean, he hasn't tried. I mean, anyway, everyone does as they're told, except insofar as they try and push the element, you know, push the envelope. He hasn't tried to do that. And in this respect, I think he's able to speak to the technocrats as one of them. Mm-hmm. Rather than as a shareholder, shall we say, saying, look, boys, you know, you guys back in the engine room, keep the engines running. I mean, he is talking to them as one of them. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, I mean, I think...
So he's like a foreman.
Yeah.
to push your metaphor farther.
Quite. I mean, and therefore, in that respect, I mean, if one looks at this, I think he's not just simply saying sort of, you know, just hold the line. I think he's saying two other things. One is, consider just how disastrous attempts at more substantive change. Because, I mean, in some ways, picking on Stolypin in this respect, I mean, I didn't sort of see it in any way as a kind of coded attack on Putin or anything like that. But instead, I mean, the interesting thing about Stolypin is two things about his reforms. One is precisely that he, you know, in the name of economic modernity, carried out what were deeply significant political and economic changes, which in the short term caused substantial, trouble. And, you know, I think what you're saying is essentially economic modernity should not be the primary driver if at the cost of that is social and political instability. But the second point is, I mean, Stolypin very clearly sort of had a long-term timeline. You know, his famous quote was, you know, give us 20 years of internal and external peace and you will not know Russia. But of course, Russia didn't have 20 years. It had World War I. Well, I mean, I think in a way, the other sort of, I would say, coded message is precisely to make the point that, you know, hard times are coming. Mm. And these are not the times to be thinking about any kind of major political or economic reshuffling of the deck, because these are precisely going to be the times when actually you need to be able to draw on the existing ties that bind society together and thus, by implication, maintain the power of the current system, rather than embarking on any bold adventures.
Right. So it's a warning to the technocrats not to rock the boat, essentially.
And that they themselves will suffer if they do rock the boat. Mm.
Sean, what do you think? What other coded messages did you see in this, if any?
What I find really, really fascinating of this is, as I said, how he understands society and how any kind of breaking of that bond in society will lead to some sort of calamity. And I think I agree with Mark in the sense that it is a warning also to the technocratic elite to not really rock the boat, that it, you know, danger is ahead. You have external and internal enemies in Russia, as we've been seeing over the last – or the belief that there's internal and external enemies in Russia, and that any type of step towards reform might unleash those forces and cause, you know, wider calamity.
Right. Now, Sean, you mentioned earlier in your earlier comments, and when we were emailing back and forth, of course, off mic, because we can only email off mic. But you were saying this, how this says a lot about the nature of Russian conservatism, and I wanted to push that a little bit more, because what is Russian conservatism? What is this wing of it that Zorkin was seemed to be advocating in this piece, and what are the other wings of it, and where is Russian conservatism? Do we have some kind of some split between like something akin to the Tea Party and Eisenhower Republicans, or what do you see?
This I see it as the kind of ideological statements that you got in, say, Putin's second term. This conservative, you know, this is kind of the middle of the Russian political spectrum in many respects. If you have the kind of, and here only speaking of elite politics, if you have this kind of more technocratic liberal side of the elite on the one hand, and now you have this very traditionalist wing on the far right that we see, especially that's cropped up around Ukraine. In the center, you have this conservative position, which is basically hold the line. And it's put in very, very legalistic terms in these kind of discussions, like Zorkin has put forward on the nature of the great reforms and how they've impacted society. It's spoken in this high intellectual discourse that I think really is about not rocking the boat of conserving essentially Russian society as it is.
Where would you put, though, the more kind of conservative reformism, where Putin would draw on Stolypin, you know, who is the, you know, had tried to be the great modernizer, and, mm-hmm. and who Putin has gone to great lengths to lionize. I mean, the celebrations of his centennial and everything, the putting up of monuments to him in Moscow. Where would you put that kind of conservatism?
I would put it in within the conservatism I'm talking about to a large extent, because in Zorkin's article he's speaking about reforms, and the first part of the article is a long discussion of the judicial reforms mm-hmm. under the great reforms, and he seems to see the need for some kind of reform. It just needs to be very careful on the one hand, And society needs to be ready for those reforms. I mean, he's really speaking about a cultural lag that occurred when the abolition of serfdom occurred. You get to the peasants are kind of lost at sea. They don't know how to govern themselves. Luckily, they still have the commune to kind of keep them binded at least. But the relationship between the elite and the peasantry has been broken. And then with the Stolypin reforms, his critique of the Stolypin reforms is that very breaking of the bonds of peasant society that kept them together, like this idea that he gave them individual freedom, but they don't know how to deal with that freedom because they have no collective sense anymore. They're just not culturally ready. So I would put there is a need for some sort of reforms, but these reforms have to be very, very careful and very well thought out and in line with conservative thinking, kind of a step-by-step process.
Right. And another thing that came out particularly in his pieces he put out in 2011, 2012, around the time of the protests, was that any change has to come from above.
Exactly.
The state has to be the center of any kind of social and political change. It can't come from below. Now, how does the kind of conservatism we've seen unleashed by the Ukraine crisis differ from this? Because it seems like a different planet from what you just described to me.
Yeah, the kind of neo-traditionalism that you get. I mean, he certainly is touching on some of this when he's speaking. He's giving this broadside against liberalism and the threat of homosexuality. This certainly speaks into this neo-traditionalist conservatism where you get basically the regulation of bodies and the self, that you get the regulation of behavior, how people practice their sex life, how people practice their family life, that we've seen really come to fore when Putin came back to the presidency. This is a far more right-wing, I think, stance than what Dworkin is taking, though he's certainly speaking to that because that's the discourse of the day.
Right.
You can also speak to a kind of very more imperialist aspect that we've seen especially since the Ukraine crisis, this project of Nova Russia, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's even further to the right of where I would position Dworkin on the political spectrum. But he certainly is, at least on the cultural front, he's certainly speaking to those kind of anxieties of the neo-traditionalists.
Right. And with that, an outright rejection of the West and everything
it stands for,
which in the past there was an attempt for some kind of accommodation.
And it speaks to his understanding of what liberalism is and his fear of individualizing society and these, you know, individual people with their own identities, with their own practices that break up the organic whole of Russian society.
Mark, your thoughts on this and how it relates to Russian conservatism and where it's at now.
Yeah, I mean, we do clearly have these three strands, the sort of the fairly sort of I hesitate to say passive, but shall I say defensive conservatism, the much more aggressive nationalist imperialist variety, and then what we could think of as a sort of a radical traditionalist agenda, which is probably closer to the sort of Tea Party-ish sort of notions, even though these things don't sort of map across.
No, of course not.
Particularly usefully. I mean, I think what's interesting is, let's go back to, you mentioned the three historical heroes of Putin.
I was hoping you were going to do that.
Stolypin, Nicholas I, and Andropov. And it's quite alarming that in many ways they are amongst my three historical heroes of Russian history. But what we have to realize is, of course, Putin cherry-picks his history. His notions of what Stolypin means, shall we say, let alone the other two, is probably not necessarily the same as mine. And I think what it brings up are a couple of points. One is that we shouldn't, as it were, assume that reform is the same as modernization. Putin is about modernization. And Putin is, you know, and modernization is really the way to a strong state, both internally and externally. And those three figures, I think, you know, he has drawn different and in some cases misleading lessons from each, I would suggest. I mean, in terms of Stolypin, he sees the fact that Stolypin was, you know, was basically willing to turn this country upside down in the name of economic modernization, but also was a very tough figure. You know, we can't forget that the Stolypin necktie, the Stolypin railway wagons.
I knew there's no way we were going to get through a discussion of Stolypin
Precisely.
Without saying the word necktie.
Exactly. You know, where would we be? I mean, let's face it, Stolypin is above all known for his necktie and his splendid beard. So I think it's this combination of you know, as it were, a radical modernizer as well as a tough maintainer, or actually not just preserver, but actually recreator of central state power, I think is what he sees in Stolypin. Rather than actually seeing that, Stolypin really stood for an assertion of the massive creative potential of individual freedoms. I mean, that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to break the commune because he realized it was dragging down the economic entrepreneurialism of a certain fraction of the peasantry. Well, you know, I don't think we can really say that Putin stands for a radical defense of individual freedom. Likewise, Yuri Andropov, yes, he became the head of the KGB. But actually, if one looks at it, I mean, he was the guy who in many ways house-trained and modernized the KGB. But also, you know, Andropov was a hard-driven believer in the system. Who lived in the same apartment for decades, never took full advantage of the opportunities for graft available to him, and was a workaholic, unlike most people within the Soviet elite, and indeed, it's fair to say, unlike Vladimir Putin himself. But also, you know, Andropov was the guy who groomed Gorbachev. Without Andropov, there would have been no Gorbachev presidency. And I think it was Andropov's brutally clear vision, His sharp understanding of quite what the dynamic of where the Soviet Union was going that was crucial in that. Putin, I would suggest, has actually withdrawn away from the harsh realities. And finally, I mean, Nicholas I, not necessarily the most sympathetic man, but nonetheless, you know, the man who was not expected to be Tsar, it was his elder brother who was meant to be Tsar, he was groomed as a military officer, and he very much took with him the attitudes of the military officer. And one of the things he was so fundamentally opposed to and horrified by was the scale of graft and embezzlement and corruption within the empire. He tried and failed, tried to do something about that. He brought in Baltic German aristocrats whom he thought were much more efficient and honest than his native Russians and so forth. But the interesting thing about Nicholas I was the extent to which he was so often essentially in competition with and opposed to his own members of the elite, precisely because of their scale of corruption, whereas Putin precisely has embraced corruption as a tool of controlling and building an elite. So, I mean, the interesting thing is I think Putin has these three historical heroes, and as far as I'm concerned, he has learned nothing from any of the three. So I think, you know, to bring it down to what's going on now, I mean, these are just ways in which an individual and an elite legitimize themselves. What is clear is that Putin wants to maintain a status quo in which there is enough resource available to the state to throw its weight around and feel like it's a great power. There is enough resource available for a corrupt elite to continue to maintain the system and allow them to continue to support Putin. The problem are precisely the technocrats, the people who are necessary to the state and yet are not being paid off on a, you know, massive scale, and who maybe still have certain ideals which are contradictory to those currently embodied within the state. And that's why he has to turn to people like Zorkin to more or less say, you know, if there's not enough of a carrot, well, fair enough, because there is also this massive stick, which is the potential for bunt, you know, the potential for everything to go crazy and mobs in the streets and cats and dogs lying down together, you know, and the sense that basically the whole world will be overturned. So that's why you need to stick with what's what.
So this, I mean, we seem to be reaching a consensus that this piece was a warning to the technocratic wing of the elite. And Mark, as long as you mention corruption, I'm not going to miss the opportunity to plug Karen Dawish's book, Putin's Kleptocracy, which went on sale in the U.S. this week. We had her on the podcast back in April, and I want to have her back on again. I just got my copy, but I just would just, as long as you mentioned that, I wasn't going to miss the opportunity to plug Karen's book. What about the other side? Now, I read the hand-wringing editorial in Vedomosti that said it is strange to hear an apology for serfdom, which presupposes inequality, from the head of the Constitutional Court, which in theory should defend the supremacy of the law and equality before the law, end quote. I don't think the person who wrote that believes that that's what the Constitutional Court actually does, but where is you get the hand wringing from places like Vedomosti. We heard a lot of commentary about it at the outset in the mashup at the beginning of this show from Dosh TV and elsewhere. But where is the other side in this argument? Is it gone? Is it silenced forever? Does it even exist? Yesterday, I was watching the VTB Investment Forum in Moscow and was surprised by German Greff's comments. He came out and said we're heading towards the Soviet economy right now. He basically rained on everybody's parade, where Putin was using that investment conference to kind of cheer everybody up and say everything's going to be fine despite the sanctions and despite the war. you're hearing these little whispers in the darkness. Is the other side silenced for good? Sean, what do you think?
Well, you're hearing whispers. I mean, what Ben was saying last week, where you have a lot of concern behind the scenes, yes. And you have a lot of rumors running around, and people don't really see where all of this is going. So it seems you do have a concern, and I think you would separate, you know, German Gref on the one hand and Vedomosti on the other. Vedomosti is going to kind of respond to an article like this with kind of somewhat shock, but somewhat kind of holding a very liberal line, whereas an insider like Gref is trying to speak is in terms of kind of putting forward a sentiment within the elite, but doing so in a way that's not going to rock too many boats. It's just going to kind of give an opinion, right, but not really suggest that it's an organized force that's going to try to do something behind the scenes. Yeah. I think the kind of technocratic side of the elite right now is really against the wall and has no much room for maneuver at this point.
No, Gref wasn't responding to this particularly, but he was responding to the current situation in Russia, and it came across crystal clear. I mean, I saw a tweet from Navalny this morning that said, gee, it's funny, Gref got the most applause at the investment forum, you know, and linked to a video of the speech. Mark, what are your thoughts? Where's the other side?
Well, I think to say the other side is the same. I mean, I think there are a variety of strands of opinion, which we are seeing in different ways being expressed. I mean, everything from the sort of kitchen table liberalism, with its sort of, you know, social media wing represented by Navalny.
But it's no longer ascendant. I mean, a year ago, you know, we would have looked at this as something ascendant.
It's no longer ascendant, sure. But the point is that what's striking is the extent to which there are multiple strands of debate if one sees it. And often these are debates within the elite. I mean, you talked about Gref. Gref is not exactly an outsider.
No,
he is speaking for a particular, you know, what we would think of, shall we say, economic reformist wing.
It's the Kudrin wing of the elite, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he's a Kudrin man.
These are not people who, in and of themselves, are supportive of, you know, political liberalism, but on the other hand, the kind of economic environment that they want to see necessarily carries with it a lot of the things that social and political liberals would also want to see, like rule of law, you know, protection of rights, and all that kind of thing. But then again, you know, we also have the essentially legalist, constitutional sort of approach conservatives like Zorkin. And also, to be honest, I mean, we don't tend to mention him much, but bless him, let's give him a call out, Medvedev, you know,
who
would also have to be fallen.
Exactly,
yeah, exactly. Some up-and-coming youngster, I'm sure. You know, but then we also have, you know, as well as obviously the sort of pure opportunists.
He used to be the head of Gazprom, right?
there are the ultras. There are the sort of... Quote, I mean, in some ways, traditionalist is wrong. Neo-traditionalists, pseudo-traditionalists, you know, who want to actually sort of push forward a rather aggressive social agenda in terms of creating a Russia that never was. And then there is a certain sort of, I think, you know, populist undercurrent that sort of is much more inchoate. But, you know, again, it's everything from, you know, corruption to why there's so many Central Asians on our streets to a whole variety of other issues. I think the interesting thing is precisely that there is no clear division lines. There is no clear forum in which these various sort of groups are able to express their views and compete and see where they have common ground. But I think, ironically, we actually see more real debate now taking place, particularly within the broadly constituted elite, than we did a year ago. But the point is, because it's in this fraught environment, it's having to be done tangentially.
And
it's having
code.
To be done
and
by exactly coded. It's in history. It's in picking on very, very specific issues. I mean, it's quite interesting if you look at the discussion about the Yevtushenkov case that we discussed last week. I mean, a lot of what is being said has nothing at all to do with Sistema or Bashneft or Yevtushenko himself. They're using it precisely as the hook on which to hang much wider arguments about what's going on. So, I mean, I think it represents, firstly, you know, a sense within the elite of concerns about the direction. Secondly, a sense of uncertainty. I mean, I think at the moment, you know, there is no real clear line coming from Putin. There are some very, very specific points, but there is no real sense that we know where we're going. And thirdly, I think there is a sense that Russians feel that they are at a kind of approaching a cusp. Mm. And therefore, it's all the more important to get these debates going and discussing, even if they're not necessarily always safe debates to be having.
Right. Okay, any last thoughts from either before we move on to the next section? All right, great. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look behind the ideological smokescreen and ask, what's the point of all this anyway? I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us also via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog at rfarl.org. You can follow us, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Они стоят, как ступени, когда горящая нефть хлещет с этажа на этаж, и откуда-то им слышится пение. И кто я такой, чтобы говорить им, что это мираж?
We've been talking a lot about ideology lately, but the fact is nobody that matters really believes this stuff. It's all a mirage to mask the machinations of a kleptocratic petrol state. To get the ball rolling for the rest of our discussion, I want to quote from a recent piece by José Ignacio Torreblanca of the European Council of Foreign Relations that caught my attention recently. Quote, despite what some Russian thinkers and ideologists would like us to think, these ex-KGB leaders and corrupt oligarchs have not embraced Orthodox religion and pan-Russian nationalism because of a desire to come to terms with the unfathomable mysteries of the Russian soul and civilization. What they are interested in is ideological manipulation to ensure their own survival. The Putin regime, through an unparalleled concentration of economic and media power, has managed a feat that will forever be remembered in the history of authoritarianism. It has achieved democratic and popular legitimacy because, yes, Putin is very popular for an extractive oligarchy that owes its existence to the overlapping of intense political authoritarianism, extreme social inequality, and undue concentrations of wealth. End quote. Torreblanca goes on to call Putin's Russia, quote, a petrol monarchy that anchors its legitimacy in a rancid nationalism rooted in religion, culture, and mythical historical battles, end quote. Now, we do that, of course. But, Mark, can this mask ever come off?
Well, first of all, I would flatly disagree that we can just assume that it's all just simply a matter of convenient masks over sort of cynical opportunists or whatever. I think actually, if you want to understand what's been going on of late, and many decisions which the Kremlin has made, which actually do not, in pure, I would say, realpolitik terms, make sense, I think you have to accept that, there is a level of belief. Of course, there's a lot of cynicism. Of course, there's a lot of attempts to rationalize personal interest in the name of the ideology. But to assume that actually neither Putin nor any of the people around him actually believe in this sort of neo-imperialist agenda we've seen, actually have any kind of belief that there is something special about Russian orthodoxy and Russian culture and sort of the Russian worldview or whatever, I think is actually to miss the point entirely. And to more or less pay them not only as Machiavellian operators, but as rather poor Machiavellian operators. I mean, let's be absolutely honest. There is no benefit for the Kremlin, no serious benefit in this current rekindled hostilities with the West. It is not something that plays strongly. It is not as if, you know, ordinary Russians in the streets were thinking, well, I don't mind that hard times are coming, because at least we have held the line on Syria or something like that. No one cares about that. Okay, I will deal with that. Yes, of course, this is a sort of a hydrocarbon autocracy that sort of like any sort of hybrid regime, veils itself behind the appearance of democracy. And it's not unusual in that respect. I mean, Torreblanca talks about an unparalleled concentration of economic and media power. Well, that's absolute nonsense. I mean, if you compare what's going on today in Russia with Stalin's Soviet Union or North Korea, actually you have far, far greater degrees of media freedom and economic diversity of assets. So, you know, I think,
great baseline there, but
but if you are going to set Russia up as this extraordinary, unusual state, I mean, I think then you ask to be taken down on the same basis. I mean, in some ways, the issue with Russia is not what's so special about it. In some ways, the issue with Russia is what's not so special about it. That you know, we have elites based on extractive industries who try to maintain a system of government to their advantage, in part by legitimating themselves with at least the appearances of democracy, and in the process actually also start to tangle themselves up in some of the commitments and expectations of democracy. That's not unusual. I think the sort of is the mask coming off or whatever. Well, sure, of course it is, but then again, the mask comes off whenever we see politicians in reality.
I mean, what made me think there might be something to this is the ideology of the regime has changed over the course of Putin's time in the Kremlin. In the past, it was, and as we talked about earlier in the podcast, it was more of this kind of conservative reformism or modernization of the Stolypin type in the first two terms. Now it's gone to this more retrograde, organic conservatism of now. And the other point I was at is this: all this stuff came up when the regime looked like it was in trouble. This newest ideological incarnation, which leads me to believe there is a bit of a smokescreen going on here. Do some of them believe some of it? Yeah, perhaps. But Sean, what are your thoughts? You read the Torreblanca piece.
I'm always kind of hesitant to when you have these arguments that one point to Putin's KGB career as the basis for all the moves he makes and all the decisions he makes, and also looking at the Kremlin as if ideology doesn't matter. Now, there, as Mark said, there's a lot of cynicism going on, but you know, politicians evolve and leaders evolve and systems evolve. And what we see now is essentially, I mean, and if you read Richard Sakwa's new book, Putin Redux, which is a really interesting book, essentially what he argues is that out of the kind of contest between who is going to be president in 2012, was it going to be Putin or were they going to give Medvedev a second term? Essentially, what he argues is that a faction within the Kremlin elite that is neo-traditionalist came to fore, that these people were always around. It's just that they came to the surface in this struggle and they backed Putin, this kind of Putinite faction, which he argues about, that came to fore in 2012. And here we get this turn to this more cultural, social neo-traditionalism that we see. So I think that, you know, this has a lot of believers, and I think we should, you know, one of the things we should keep in mind is that if they do believe in all this stuff, in the Nova Russia and this anti-homosexualism, if this is actual belief, this is far scarier than if they're cynical.
That's true to be sure. I mean, and I'm sure it's a hybrid. What I found interesting about the Torreblanca is like, again, it's stuff we've heard before, but I hadn't quite heard. Now, that first part I had heard put that way. But the other argument he makes in his book, which I found really fascinating, was that Putin's entire time in power has been one big spetsaparazzi. It was one big special operation. I know you think he played the KGB thing over blew this, but I think this in this sense it is kind of relevant. He quotes the political scientist Ivan Krastev, whose work I do like. Let me quote more from Torreblanca if you can bear with me here for a minute, because I think this is pretty interesting. He says political scientist Ivan Krastev argues that to understand Putin, one must understand how a KGB agent thinks. The job of the KGB man, unlike a member of the military of the Communist Party apparatchik, is not to create hierarchical structures and keep them under control, but to infiltrate and capture them while maintaining the appearance of normal operation. To succeed in this task, he must understand people's key motivations and aspirations. Here, Putin has demonstrated his genius. Those who wanted money have been well paid, and those who longed for identity have had their lost self-esteem restored. That old KGB operative who confesses he always wanted to be a secret agent has conducted a brilliant operation. Russia has been transformed into a double agent, which, while appearing to serve the Russians, allows these KGB ex-agents to maintain power and to control the apparatus of the state as well as its economic and media levers. End quote. I think that's a pretty interesting formulation, Mark. You're the expert in special operations. I mean, leave aside, yeah, all right, playing up the Putin KGB card is overblown and it's overdone. This is a pretty interesting way to formulate it. And it's exactly what he's done in terms of infiltrating various parts of civil society, the political structures. What would you say about this, Mark?
Well, I would say that in many ways, what he's done is what every state does, quite frankly. I think there's a danger in seeing strategy when, in fact, Putin's policies, like those of almost every leader, actually tend to represent opportunism and a response to circumstance. I mean, the situation that Putin was in his first two terms were dramatically different. The West was distracted by the whole sort of threat of terrorism and so forth, and was eager for friends, and therefore that was handy for Putin. Oil and gas prices were nice and strong, that the money was rolling in and such like. And I think he clearly at that point believed that it was useful for Russia to be sort of connected to the West. I mean, he saw Russia's future in partnership rather than in confrontation more than anything else. And I don't think it was because of a kind of cynical sense of, aha, we will now infiltrate their structures until the point where we can
not
rip
the
off
West.
Their masks.
No, we're talking about infiltrating Russia. He turned Russia into a double agent, according to...
Wow. I mean, hot news. An elite lie to the masses so that they can maintain their own power. I mean, that is so unlike what we find in every other country. I mean, of course, there's different structures and different levels. It's very different. But I mean, actually, the difference between Russia and the West is much more about what are the checks and balances, what are the institutions. I mean, I don't believe, frankly, that a member of the Russian elite is any more rapacious or bloody-minded than a member of the Western elite. It's just that the Western elite operate in far, far less permissive environments. They're much more likely to get, caught by the tax inspectors, sent to prison if they try and sort of have their opponents whacked or whatever. They can't just go and raid other companies because they've paid a judge to stamp some, fake signature or whatever. I dare say there's a lot of Western, oligarchs, I would say, who'd love to be in a position where they could do all of those things. Now, I mean, I'm not trying to say that this is all entirely the same. I mean, I just feel the idea that there's been this Machiavellian long-term plan to build up some kind of spetsop, only then to be able to suddenly say, aha, now we're in our rightful place. Represent just simply the fact that, look, elites will seek to expand and develop their power. And I also think that there's a contradiction in the sense that Torreblanca says that Putin built his entire career on the desire to avenge the humiliation suffered by Russia. Well, that sounds pretty ideological to me. I mean, that actually sounds like this is someone who's motivated by belief rather than just simply an entirely pragmatic view. To say, okay, so people who wanted money got money and people who wanted identity got identity. Well, isn't that what a politician does? You find what people want and you give them that, as long as in return they give you what you want. It's not that I would necessarily disagree with a lot of the specifics of what he's saying happened, because, of course, they did. I think it's to suggest, A, that they represent some grand plan rather than just a sort of a natural instinct, and B, that they represent something that is particularly different from what you'd find in two dozen different other countries around the world. Mm. That's where I would query.
Sean, your thoughts?
Yeah, my problem with this formulation of this special operation is that it falls in line with the way that Russia is viewed a lot throughout its history by outsiders, and that is it's ruled by some sort of conspiracy. And I think this really gets us away from understanding how Russia is ruled, because Putin and the elite are like, as Mark said, are like similar to other elites, where they have to react to circumstances. They have to react to forces that are outside of their control. And a lot of this reaction we see on the part of Putin, in the sense that there doesn't seem to be a grand plan of step of moving forward. There doesn't seem to be a wider conspiracy going on. Yes, they do want to hold on to power, as Mark said, like any elite does, but they have to do that within certain constraints and react to certain events. And this puts forward a far more chaotic and I would say far more human aspect of understanding Russia, rather than there's a large conspiracy and that Putin and the elite have all this control. They can run roughshod over any constraint, that they have control over all events, that they're some sort of all-seeing, all-powerful entity. It's just not the case. They're actually far more weaker and they're far more human.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I see a grand conspiracy, and I'm not so sure Tora Blanca sees a grand conspiracy. But as far as conspiracies go, the sociologist Boris Kagarlitsky said probably the wisest thing I ever heard about conspiracies in Russia. He said, the question in Russia is never whether there is a conspiracy afoot. There's always many conspiracies afoot. And the question to ask is which one is actually succeeding. Which was probably the wisest thing. Now, as far as this, I want to continue with Tora Blanca and give you guys more chance to shoot him down some more. But in bringing it up into the present, into the Ukraine crisis, he says, quote, Putin has linked Russia's fate to Ukraine and now cannot afford to lose the centerpiece of his Eurasian project. Thus, he is stuck in an alley in which he can neither advance nor retreat. If he goes forward, he will enter into an economic confrontation with the West, which would destabilize his petrol state, impoverishing his oligarchs and inflaming public opinion. If he retreats and abandons his minions in eastern Ukraine, he will be criticized for cowardice in selling the Russian soul and identity in exchange for a few coins. He will do what he will, but one thing is clear, a leader who has built his entire political career on the desire to avenge the humiliation suffered by Russia will not allow himself to be humiliated in the end. Mark's already made short work of that last sentence. Mark, you want to have a crack at the rest of the passage?
Well, I mean, actually, let me sort of flip around. I mean, there is a kernel of truth in all this, absolutely. I mean, I think Putin has put himself in a position in which there are no particularly good channels forward. You know, he has proven tactically highly able and strategically inept with Ukraine in sort of triggering this whole unnecessary and dangerous for him conflict with the West at a time when, anyway, you know, economic hard times were looming for Russia, and actually he needed Western credits and support. But on the other hand, I mean, I think this is perhaps painted in slightly too apocalyptic terms. If Putin backs down again, I can't actually see that sort of you'll get mobs on the streets saying, you know, why have you sort of sold our Russian birthright?
No, but his legitimacy would take a serious hit.
It would take a hit, exactly. But the point is, unless there's someone willing to push at that point, then, you know, you can afford to take a legitimacy hit when you basically have no opposition, when there is no mechanism for anyone to exploit that. Now, yeah, I think what we're really talking about is a long-term rather than a short-term threat, that one way or the other, Putin is not going to come out of this well. Even if he strikes some kind of a deal, I don't know, or even just simply if the West folds, which is not, unfortunately, impossible, and the sanctions regime is largely, you know, relaxed, well, still, there will be a longer-term legacy. I mean, we've already seen it in terms of, you know, multinationals pulling out of Russia, pulling their expats out of Russia. Russia is now once again seen as a more problematic area. Even without the sanctions regime, I think people will be more hesitant about moving money and businesses into Russia and entering into partnerships. So there will be issues for the Russian economy, but also the Russian elite. And it's not so much the oligarchs as the bureaucrats who are the issues in the longer term. And likewise, if he pulls out, yes, of course, there will be a legitimacy hit, having constructed so much of his persona as the valiant defender of Russians and Russian interests abroad. That, but the point is, it's more that just simply, I think it slightly accelerates the slide towards the point, as we were discussing last week, actually Putin faces some kind of real challenge. I don't think it's something that will be happening imminently anyway.
Sean?
Yeah, I've read this line in other places too, where Putin has boxed himself in a corner, which he has, but that one side of this corner is either victory or utter defeat, and it's just not the case. I mean, and it all depends on what is meant by the Eurasian project? What is Putin's goal in Ukraine? If his goal is to absorb Ukraine into some sort of greater Russia or make Ukraine part of some sort of Eurasian Union, this is a different story. But if Putin's goal is far more minimalist, where he wants a neutral Ukraine that doesn't join the EU anytime soon, which it won't, and certainly doesn't join NATO, then he seems to be succeeding on this level. He's destabilizing Ukraine enough that they can't get their act together. And the question is, if they can get their act together without Russian intervention is a different question. But but at least the disturbance in the East is preventing them from consolidating power and moving on to far more pressing issues with the economy. He seems to be succeeding quite well at this, and I don't. And while the ideology of Novorossiya has been, you know, in the media and amongst the public, I think this could be quickly dialed down quite easily. They can back off of this, just taper it off, and the population will move on to other concerns. Mm-hmm. And especially if you have to consider how much of the population is really invested in all of this. Is a question that I have. We might be fooled by all of the media discussion of Eastern Ukraine and Novorossiyan fascists and the junta, whereas regular Russians might not be as engaged as we think they are on
all
this. Well,
yeah, I'd like to see. We're also fooled by the top line numbers in public opinion polls, which are notoriously unreliable in Russia. But I'd like to see some real focus groups. I mean, it's impossible to do in this environment, probably. But I would like to see that. That is a good point. How much the population is truly invested in it. A couple of points, though, to wrap up. I mean. On Ukraine, my feeling right now is that, I mean, no matter what happens in the East, whether it turns into a frozen conflict forever, and no matter what happens in Crimea, Russia has lost the rest of Ukraine, I think, perhaps forever. A poll that caught my eye this week, more than 50% of Ukrainians now favor joining NATO. More than 50% of Ukrainians have never favored joining NATO, and they do now. That's a poll. Now, that's, of course, without Crimea and without the occupied areas of Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. But that's going to be Ukraine, basically, if these conflicts end up getting frozen and Crimea stays where it is. These areas will be disputed. But the Ukraine that's going to be voting in elections, electing governments that set state policy. Well, 50%, more than 50% of that wants to join NATO, and that number is probably going to grow. The number is even high in the Russian speaking regions, which tells you something. So I think Putin has lost the rest of Ukraine, possibly forever. The other thing is some economic numbers I saw this week that caught my eye. Oil is floating around $90 a barrel, and actually was below $90 a barrel for a bit this week. Inflation could be up to 8% this year. It's at 8.1 right now, and it could be higher than 8%. For the year, which is almost double what the central bank's target was, and economic growth is down, and the sanctions are in their early stages and might still get tougher. So, this could get more. I don't want to use the word apocalyptic, Mark, but this could get a little more nastier than we think. And this corner that Tota Blanca paints Putin in might be. More dangerous place than we think, and in maybe in a shorter term than we think. Any final thoughts before we wrap it up for this week?
I mean, I think I just simply say in terms of dangers and whatever. I mean, what are the dangers? Yes, of course. Putin has made a disastrous blunder in terms of provoking this additional sort of confrontation both with Ukraine and the West as a whole. And I agree. I think he has lost the rest of Ukraine. Whether he necessarily cares, again, I mean, I think this is not someone who necessarily sort of thinks in terms of do the Ukrainians, do the people of Lviv love me or not? I don't think it's not something that keeps them awake at night.
Oh, they don't. A poll shows that's fair 75% to say, yeah. of Ukrainians view Putin negatively, and I imagine that number is much higher in Lviv than in Ukraine as a whole.
I dare say. But as I said, I mean, I don't think that bothers him. I mean, as long as he has... essentially the guarantees that he needs that basically Ukraine is not going to become part of Western structures. 50% of Ukrainians might want to join NATO. I can guarantee you that 50% of NATO leaders do not want Ukraine. So that actually, I think that in those kind of crude terms, he probably thinks exactly that he's got what he wants. I just don't think he's figuring in the full impact of quite the sort of the longer term implications.
Or the cost.
But yeah, yeah, exactly. But this is, you talk about cost. I mean, again, this is the killer. Actually, you know, oil prices that are below that sort of magic $100 mark that we tend to reckon is the point at which Russia is comfortable. And likewise, you know, inflation beginning to bite at
moving
a time
towards
when,
double
when,
digits.
It's moving towards double digits, and we're not seeing, and we won't see any kind of comparable increase in wages, let alone pensions. I mean, pensions is definitely going to be something that will really bite, even before they took a great big chunk out to pay for Crimea. These are all, though, these are long-term challenges. I mean, I think the point is that a regime can survive quite a bit of slide as long as it has security apparatuses, as long as it has ability to spin media and so forth. Just ask the sort of the late Brezhnevians, you know, how long they were able to survive. The point is, what it means is you actually have brittleness. If some kind of challenge comes along, and it could be a challenge in terms of some, you know, international crisis, it could be some sudden global or economic downturn, it could be that Putin has a stroke. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all kinds of things. I think that it means that the system has so much less resilience to be able to deal with the unexpected.
Mm. One other thing I would add along the economic difficulties I forgot to mention is that I saw a news item this week that the benefit the state pays to people for having children is going to be cut. So as Russia shifts to a war economy, it's the social programs that are taking the hit. And at the same time, a law is on the books in the Duma. If some they're called the Rothenberg law, if an oligarch gets his assets seized in the West as a result of sanctions, guess who's going to bail him out? The Russian taxpayer. So there this is again, you can only how much can you squeeze your people is the question. Sean, final words to you before we wrap up. You don't have any final words, so we'll just wrap up. All right. That is about all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Thank you, gentlemen, for the interesting and enlightening discussion.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and totally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, including the newly launched Power Vertical feed. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.